This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Is that it then? Just weeks ago we had a three-horse race, kind of, but now City pull away. They do a professional job at Brentford. Phil Foden, the best City man in the world this week. Remember when we all said they needed a centre forward? Leicester ruined the title race by following up defeat to City by beating Liverpool. Jurgen Klopp not happy, but perhaps not the unhappiest German in the top three. Thomas Tuchel in a right old mood after Brighton turned XG into GG, or just G, in injury time. Elsewhere, Joe Linton, midfield maestro, as Newcastle hold Manchester United. Harry Kane gives us a great chance to finish the year, talking about toenails, noses and shoulders pinging the offside VAR machine. We'll of course discuss the postponements, player welfare and what clubs and players should do. And also today, do we disrespect the Africa Cup of Nations? Is it purely the timing of the tournament or something more sinister than that? All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Jacob Steinberg, welcome.
Hi.
And Troy Townsend, how are you, mate?
Yeah, not too bad. Always a pleasure to be back.
Okay, you sound like you mean it, Troy. So let's crack on. Johnny says, is football a bit farcical at the minute with cancellations of some games and others featuring very depleted teams due to COVID, or do we just need to keep going and get through this? I know that is hanging over pretty much all the games that we're watching, and we will talk about that once we've gone through the actual football. And we'll start with the top three. Liverpool dropping 9 points behind Manchester City in the title race after that defeat at Leicester. They could be 12 points behind City by the next time they play. Their next game, Liverpool's, is against Chelsea, so that's more drop points. Chelsea have dropped 9 points in December. Is it all over, Wilson?
No, but nearly, yes. I think even sort of 6-7 weeks ago, when it looked like we might have a three-horse race, I think there was a sense that one of those three teams was entirely capable of winning 10 or 12 or 15 games in a row. And I think it was pretty obvious that City were the most likely of the three because they've got the deepest squad. Liverpool haven't done a lot wrong until dropping the points at Tottenham, which I guess you could say was partly down to the midfield they put out, and then getting beaten at Leicester when they just seemed incredibly flat. It was almost like, it's one of those where you sort of not sure which comes first. Has Klopp noticed that his squad's lost energy and started complaining about it? Or has he started complaining about it and the squad's gone, actually, yeah, I am quite tired. But they were really flat in that game. I mean, you can say they may be a bit unlucky to lose it. But once the penalty had been missed, I sort of always had that sense that they were struggling and that they were vulnerable on the break. And at the same time, Chelsea have that defence that had seen them through the first 2 or 3 months of the season, that's become slightly fallible. Which, is, again, you can say is partly down to injuries, possibly, that the absence of Kovacic, particularly from midfield, Kante having time out. Jorginho, I think, has looked tired. In certainly that West Ham game, he looked knackered the last sort of 20 minutes, half an hour of that game. And City just, march on and are able to leave out Foden and Grealish for disciplinary reasons because their squad is so deep.
Mm. And able to leave out and not make any changes last night and leave out Sterling, Mahrez and Gundogan, right, who will all probably come in the next game.
Absolutely.
Jacob, I'm sad about it. I really thought we might have it this year. Is there anything to cling to?
I think you're relying on City out of nowhere doing something they don't usually do, which is dropping points against teams that they routinely hammer. It's very hard to see them doing something like we saw Newcastle do or in 95 or United in 98, which is blow that kind of lead, which I think in itself is quite a deflating thought because it's not even January and already you just can't see where those slip ups are coming for with City. They are so good and they're so well coached and as a club so well organized that they've just made it routine that you are going to need about 95 points to challenge them, which I don't think is great for the league. I don't think it makes for necessarily a great title race. If you go back to the title race in 2019 between Liverpool and City when it goes to the last day. I don't think that was necessarily the greatest title race we've seen, even though it went to the end, because it was just Liverpool and City routinely beating teams every single week. There was no real sense of major jeopardy in that title race that that you might have seen in for example, when United won the treble in 99, or even, you know, something like 2014, when you had a three-horse race, where you did have at least a sense of the teams at the top, while being very good, being slightly fallible at least, and it not being such a disaster for them to drop points. I mean, if you take Liverpool, they went how long unbeaten before going to West Ham at the start of November and losing to a team who were, I think, went into that game fourth or third that day. It shouldn't be a major disaster to lose that game for Liverpool, but you thought that day, well, they haven't got many more chances, have they? And similarly, Chelsea, in this whole run that they've been, and there's this little stutter that they've had, it's only, I think, one defeat at West Ham, who are a good side. And
it's your fault, Jacob. It's West Ham. It's your fault.
You have to keep winning all the time to keep pace with City. You can't. Chelsea have only had draws. It's only been draws that are holding them back. They've not necessarily done loads wrong. They've had a bit of a stutter, but that stutter is just enough just to wipe out the title race. Now, it does make it an absurd level that you have to reach, and it probably makes Chelsea and Liverpool look worse than they are. That said, I don't have loads of sympathy for Chelsea, because they are fully part of this super club era. They are owned by a Russian billionaire, and they have played a part in the conditions that have made this the level that you need to reach, and have made it so difficult for the rest of the league to compete as well.
I'm sort of jumping around these games involving the top three, but there was a question from John Troy, which says, look, how can anyone compete with Manchester City? Is it just a case of waiting for Pep to retire?
It's an interesting question. Listen, none of them were good this week, were they? None of them, you know, they were grinding out results. Man City, a very un-Man City-like performance, I thought. They grinded out a result. Brentford had a little bit of energy without really causing them too much trouble, but City weren't great, and they were a little bit dysfunctional at times as well. But they got the 3 points, and at the end of the day, people remember that they've gone 8 points clear. Liverpool and Chelsea couldn't get over the line. Chelsea's home record has not been great, considering the amount of drop points they've had at home, and Liverpool looked like what Klopp was saying they were going to look like. So it was really interesting. But with City, you just think that they've got another more gears to go. Like you said, no substitutions made, holding people back for Arsenal, no doubt. And hopefully winning that fixture. So it was an interesting round of games without the real excitement that probably the Boxing Day games had. But again, City come out trumps, and I think Pep pulls out all the strokes when he needs to. Still no number nine, but still scoring goals and still winning games.
I mean, that is fascinating. I mean, Foden was brilliant, and there's always one player, Wilson, for City who is brilliant for either a month or 2 months or that particular day. He came back into the side, didn't he? And it was a lovely finish. It is so interesting that we spent some weeks just talking about how they had to get a centre forward. And I think their highest goal scorer only got 7 goals. Like they just share them around.
I'm not sure everybody was saying they had to get a centre forward. I think there was a significant body of opinion that said the way City play without a centre forward probably, you know, in some holistic sense, makes them a better team, a more difficult team to combat. However, when they have games like the away game in Paris, when they sort of slightly run out of ideas, when the mechanisms aren't quite as slick as they can be when they're at their best, then they don't have that plan B that having, say, Lukaku up front would give them. You know, that game against PSG, I mean, I think they still won the XG there kind of quite comfortably. But because of the way PSG played, the sort of essentially it was almost like a 7-0-3 or a 4-3-0-3. And so City had loads of the ball, you know, in the first sort of 10, 15 yards, 20 yards of the PSG half. So they had loads of great crossing opportunities, but nobody to cross it to. And, you know, they sort of, the way they play commits them to try and play three teams. Now, normally they're good enough they can do that. That one particular night, you thought maybe they could have done with more of a centre-forward to aim at, but yeah, that's a rare circumstance when things go wrong. So Yeah, I think City are a great example of the best of modern football, that they are this great unit. And that's something I think that, there's two different things going on there. So one is that the finances of the game are sort of stacked in their favour, that they have huge advantages other teams don't have. But they are also brilliant, and Pep is also brilliant, and they have brilliant players, and they do play brilliant football. Of course, the way they can afford Pep is by being incredibly rich.
Jacob, you see a lot of Chelsea. Thomas Tuchel was pretty mardy yesterday. Have you found him quite a mardy bloke, or not really?
Not generally, since he had a reputation, obviously, when he arrived in January, replacing Lampard, of being a difficult man. That's what one of the guys at Dortmund described him as, a brilliant coach, I think, and a very difficult guy. And we were wondering what he was going to be like, and was he going to be very difficult to sort of work with in his press conferences and so on. But, you know, generally he's just been very, very intelligent and funny and articulate and honest about his team when things go wrong. And that's actually suddenly switched in the last couple of weeks. The gradual build up of the injuries, the COVID problems that they've had, the sense of the team suddenly slowing down has kind of got to him. And last night after after that draw with Brighton, he felt a little bit lost. It felt, you know, he was just struggling really. There wasn't any real analysis of the game. It was all about the injuries and, you know, him saying it would be, how can we possibly compete now with all the injuries and problems that we've had, basically writing off the title chances. And I think it will be interesting to see where he does go from here. You know, there was that line where he said, "I will protect my team," which I think is going to be an important thing, because you know how quickly things can deteriorate at Chelsea when there's that sense of the manager not getting on with the players and the players starting to turn. And we've seen it happen with so many managers. So I think it's quite a little crucial period for him to get through this and make sure that everything doesn't suddenly turn into a major crisis at Chelsea. He's just so disappointed with the way that things have fallen apart.
We have to acknowledge the performances, though, of Leicester City and Brighton during those games, don't we? Because they were both teams who also have been decimated in the same way that the big clubs have, but they produced performances that warranted the result. Brighton maybe more than what they've got, to be totally honest, but a great equaliser at the end by Welbeck, and Leicester City, you know, with makeshift centre-halves in. Sorry, I got my words twisted there.
I mean, make shit is hard, but you know, it's a bit harsh, but fair enough.
But yeah, all round the park, Leicester City were really, really good. And obviously when Lookman came on, he exposed their right-hand side, which no one had done. And Brighton controlled the game after a period of time yesterday, didn't they? They, you know, again, on the ball, they were really good. It was that moment where we thought, were they going to get it? Were they not? And Cucurella's cross for Welbeck to head home was just brilliant. So, you know, we have to acknowledge those players.
I really like Cucurella, Troy. There's something about, you know, he looks like he's having a jolly old time.
Just having a fun time. There. Yeah, he does. Yeah. He made a foul in the first half, didn't he? And Mike Dean called him over. And he seemed really happy that Mike Dean was going to speak to him as well. And, you know, he acknowledged it all and then ran away as if this big kid playing in a Premier League game. But yeah, he's been a really, really good signing for them.
Clearly he hasn't played in the Premier for that long. If he's looking forward to chatting to Mike Dean. How do we feel about, I saw someone moaning about spider cam and like Mo Salah's penalty. Wilson, do you like that angle of the penalty?
No, I hate it. I hate it.
Right.
Me too.
It's fine for a replay, and I can see for a replay, it gives you angles and insights and you get closer than you would do normally. But I couldn't work out what happened. You know, the header that hit the bar, obviously, once you work out what happens, you can see from that angle what's happened. But I just sort of thought, he just headed it straight up in the air. I didn't realise it had gone forward, hit the bar and bounced out again. And I couldn't work, you know. And I maybe it's one of those things that you would get used to it. But I just sort of think there's no need to be arty in your direction of live football. Just show me the game. And also the way the spider cam sweeps, it makes me feel slightly nauseous.
Right.
But just
a sort of fairy vibe. It's a
yeah. You know. I just sort of think when the action is live, you only need two cameras. You have two cameras on the halfway line, one of which tracks the action, one of which keeps a slightly wider shot. And that is absolutely fine because the fixed perspective is what allows you to sort of follow the game. And then you use the other cameras for the follow-ups. But just on the point of injuries generally, I don't know if it's even possible to track this. But my sense is this season has been, even before this wave of a pandemic, that this season's been more affected by injuries than any other I sort of remember. Because Everton clearly have struggled with injuries, losing their entire spine for a while.
Leeds,
Leicester. Jacob mentioned the problems that Brighton and Wolves have had.
Newcastle.
Newcastle at the minute as well. That suddenly clubs seem to be losing six or seven players at once. And I guess it's always happened that a club has suffered that, but for it to happen to sort of quarter of the league, I just wonder if it's a cumulative effect of trying to sort of squeeze, three and a half seasons into 3 years, even before this latest Omicron wave, that maybe we're paying the price for that.
On the Chelsea game, I mean, Tuchel wanted a penalty when Pulisic went down. Jacob, he thought Mason Mount shouldn't have been penalised when he tackled somebody and then put the ball in the net. He did kind of ignore that Rudiger absolutely hurtling into Tarek Lamptey from about 100 miles away moment, didn't he?
He did. And got to say that Lamptey against his old team, I think that was his first game back at Stamford Bridge, played against them once last season, I think, then got injured at home when he was very good. But Lamptey was absolutely brilliant last night, and that was up against Reece James, who was playing on the left, because obviously another bad thing for Chelsea is that Chilwell's out now for the season because he needs that surgery on his knee. And so Tuchel had Reece on the left, seeing if he could do a job there. And then he goes off injured with a hamstring, leaves on crutches afterwards, probably going to be out for a while. But he tried him on the left, and Lamptey just had a lot of fun against him because, he's Reece James is right-footed and he looked very uncomfortable. Lamptey is a very enjoyable player when he gets going, so quick, and Chelsea didn't seem to know what to do with him until Rudiger, who always kind of plays quite close to the edge and is kind of a red card waiting to happen, produced the tackle that should have got him a red card. I couldn't believe it it was just that they didn't even seem to go to VAR. No one wasn't sent over, and it felt to me exactly like the tackle that Kane put in on Robertson last week as well, which, again, not a red card. I was very surprised. It was really wild from Rudiger, and maybe just sort of showed that Chelsea completely lost control, because Brighton just make it so difficult for so many sides. They force so many errors from teams, and if they had a finisher, then, maybe they'd be challenging City.
We'll get on to offsides like that Laporte header when we talk about Harry Kane and Spurs. But I wonder, Troy, if I've heard a lot of people getting... We seem to be relaxed about VAR for a few months. And now everything I hear is Mike Riley. There isn't a place in hell for Mike Riley. Mike Riley, he's the worst human to have ever walked the earth. How dare Mike Riley? He is responsible for every ill that has ever happened in the universe. Do you want to add some more, or have I castigated Mike Riley enough?
You've done that enough. But yeah, I think you're right. Everyone kind of like was just, oh, it's VAR. We've gone to the monitor, or there's another really strong red line. And I think we'd become bored of it. And I think because it wasn't the most topic of conversation, that VAR has decided that it needs to be that topic of conversation again. And some of these honestly, I was hoping not to address this today, but some of these decisions, I'm lost. I really am lost because, again, you look at Kane, you look at Laporte, you look at Foden, you look at Emil Smith Rowe, you look at Son, and I can't tell the difference. It might be me. My eyes might not be attuned to the lines that are being drawn, the thicker lines, the thinner lines, I don't know. But I just think that it's just almost as if there's not enough people talking about it. We need to create some more controversy. Here we go. There we go. VAR's back as the major topic of conversation again. Who cares about Omicron or injuries or whatever else? We need to be front and center. I just think that it's all, I've made my views clear on VAR on a number of occasions. I just think it's all over the place again. And I'm not quite sure at what stage we're at the moment. Like what Jacob just said about the Rudiger challenge, the Kane challenge, you know, these things are being reviewed and they're being passed as, no, that's okay. I don't know where the bar is anymore on offside, on fouls, on whatever it is that goes on in that box. That's for sure. Is that enough?
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. It was excellent. I mean, we'll clip that up and send it to Mike Riley. Wilson, what do you feel about it?
I struggle to get excited by the offsides. I still think it's more accurate than a 45-year-old bloke running for 50 yards away. I mean, I think in time what needs to happen is that all players have a chip inserted in their chest, maybe.
Right.
And as Sean Dyche was saying this week, they get paid enough, player welfare, you know, bollocks to it, they get paid loads. Get a chip inserted into their chest. If you want to be professional players, sorry, that's part of what you have to go through. And then we can measure from those chips. And maybe that's the only way we can do it.
Then you have Piers Corbyn signing up.
It's not what we need, is it? I don't need Piers Corbyn yelling at Mike Riley.
In fairness, I would very much like to see that. Mike Riley waving him away. But maybe outside all NHS testing centres now, we need a statue of or an automated model of Mike Riley waving people away, walking slowly backwards, looking slightly scared.
Anyway. Mike, finally in part one, the commentary team on Amazon says, Mike, we're talking about how the Brentford ground staff let the pitch grow to slow down City. Are there any other examples of shithousery by a team staff? Paul recollected Sir Alex Ferguson telling Brian Kidd to, quote, fucking flood it, preparing the Old Trafford pitch for Monaco at home in 1998. Obviously, I grew up with John Beck, who would do everything. You know, he would take under-18 teams to away games and they had the, you know, you'd have half the pitch. He'd play a full game between his entire under-18 squad to just churn up the pitch and cover the corners in sand so the ball would land, I presume.
Brian Clough did it against Benfica, didn't he, when he was Derby manager. He had the pitch flooded. I think Revy did it for Leeds against... It was a Spanish team. Was it Zaragoza, I think? And they lost anyway. Was it quite a recent game? I want to say Galatasaray v Inter?
Right.
I think it was an Italian team anyway, where they only removed the snow from one half of the pitch at half time.
Oh, great.
So the Galatasaray were attacking the snowless bit and defending the...
That's really good.
So, I mean, the sort of common thing is to take in the touchline to be playing against a team with good wingers. But I'm kind of in favour of that. I think home advantage is home advantage. It's the same with cricket. If you've got a load of spinners, prepare a turning track. If you've got a load of seamers, keep it green. I think home advantage within reasonable parameters... Do what you want.
And that's pretty much the only reason why England lost the Ashes, isn't it? That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do the race for the top four. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Perhaps the race for the top four is the exciting thing for us to cling hold of. Now, Arsenal, West Ham, Spurs, Manchester United, probably between them. Manchester United 7 points off Arsenal, 2 games in hand. They drew at St James's Park. I mean, United weren't good. Newcastle look like they've got a bit more about them now. Joel Linton in centre mid was a curious thing. But Fraser says, is Joel Linton the best box-to-box midfielder in the Barclays, he says?
Yeah, maybe he was just being used in the wrong way by Steve Bruce. He has been surprisingly good since Eddie Howe's come in, and maybe showing why they did spend all that money on him and that he wasn't the complete dud that everybody thought he was. And obviously... when you watch Newcastle, then the player that you're always drawn to is Sam Maximan, who I think is way too good to be playing in a relegation battle. And if that's where they're going to stay, then you'd imagine that's not where he will. Or if they do suddenly turn into a superpower, that he's going to be very much part of that, because he is so good. That goal was brilliant. It was just a shame that he sort of turned into Timo Werner when he was in front of goal 3 yards out and put it straight against David De Gea. They should have won, but I think the worry for them would be that obviously he went off, and that Callum Wilson, who again is a really, really good centre forward and too good to have gone down with Bournemouth 2 years ago, and too good to be in another relegation battle, has gone off and probably is going to be out for a while. Read that they're probably going to buy Kieran Trippier from Atletico Madrid, but now that they'll probably need to go in for a centre forward as well. So, you know, that's going to be difficult for them to do in January. They've obviously got the game called off against Everton, but they have played, although they're looking good, they have played more than a lot of the teams around them, particularly Burnley. So while they're not that far off, the table just can look a little bit deceptive because of all the disruption. And you do worry still with Newcastle, if you happen to worry for Newcastle, that they have just wasted too many chances, and that this is just maybe going to come a little bit too late, because they've still only won one match, and that's not very good.
Yeah, it isn't. You're right. We're still getting, you know, we're getting closer to January, Troy. Bob says, who are the pod most excited about Newcastle announcing in January? Mbappe, Julio, Jordio, the Honey Monster, or the Ghost of Maradona? It seems strange that Kieran Trippier would want to go from Atleti to Newcastle. You know, like, as Jacob was saying, you know, Saint-Maximin, Wilson are players of quality that shouldn't be in a relegation scrap. They are in one. And I've asked this question before, but I just totally sort of bewilderingly fascinated to know who would go.
Well, listen, Max, if you put enough money on the table, then you're likely to attract quite a number of players who believe that they'll be the players responsible for helping them out of the situation that they're in. No player is too good to be involved in a relegation battle, by the way. You are there because that's the club you play for, and you're part of that club. We've seen players in the past who have been performing at the best of their abilities. Wilf Zaha is one, but they always seem to be involved down near the bottom of the table with their club. So it's one of those where you think to yourself, Newcastle, they could possibly pluck anyone they want, but then is anyone going to want to go to a team that has won one game at this stage of the season? And that's the biggest story. I mean, Trippier, an aging fullback, not played in the Premier League for a while, obviously going to be better than the fullbacks they've got. Still has, obviously, will believe that he can play for England. Yes, maybe, but is he the answer to the problems? If Wilson's out for 6 weeks, they desperately need to get a number nine in, and Joe Linton now has proved that he's not the number nine. He's now more of a number eight or marauding central midfield player that does other things now. So they need to find players that will put the ball in the back of the net, and no matter how much money you got, that's never going to be easy. So I think until they get to the end of January, we'll start to realise what kind of team Newcastle will have moving forward.
Troy, you're in many ways closer to a Premier League footballer than any of us, right? You just said, you know, that if you offer enough money, players will go. Have you ever had a chat with anyone close to you to say that? Like, 50 grand a week's probably enough, mate. You know, like, you don't need 100 or whatever it may be. I don't have details on that. But like, surely someone at some point tells footballers, you might want 300 grand a week, but like, you pretty much do what you want once you've got 150.
Yeah, but when you talk about Newcastle now, and everyone's going to think, right, they are loaded and they're going to bring in this new era. It's not a bad place to live. It's not a bad club to be involved in if things are going well. Then, you know, let's say 100 grand a week, and you say, nah, well, do you know what? I actually need 120. You're going to push for it. You're going to push for it, and you're going to want it. And I don't think Newcastle will go, well, we're not going up to 120 grand a week. The thing is, there's going to be players thrown at that club as well now, players that we may have never even heard of thrown at that football club, and they're going to have to make massive decisions. So, we've heard the rumours of a director of football and whatever else coming in, because it's going to be a tough one for Eddie Howe to deal with by himself. So it's one of those where there's going to be so much at their disposal, and they're going to have to make the right choices, because the, you know, if they do it wrong in January, the likelihood is that they'll keep tumbling down and maybe not just survive. So it's a tough one. It's a tough one, but you'd rather have the money than be in a situation like some of the other clubs around them and not have the money and be able to hopefully pick who they'd like.
Antonio Conte's become the first Spurs manager to go undefeated in his first seven league games, Wilson. 3 wins, 4 draws. But if you're going for top four against 10 men for 50 minutes, it's not really good enough, is it?
I mean, they're much, much better.
Am I being harsh?
I mean, look, it's obviously a disappointment to draw a game like that, but they're a million times better now than they were 3 months ago. So, I mean, the direction of travel is definitely in the right direction. You assume they'll spend in January. I know Tottenham have sort of suggested that they don't have money to spend, but I can't believe Conte would have taken that job without at least some kind of promise of the budget. So, I would imagine they'll bring in, one or two players. I also sort of think if you're a Premier League club now, the Premier League seems to have been less affected economically by the pandemic than other leagues. Now is probably a pretty good time to be shopping in Europe.
I enjoyed Mohamed Salisu's foul for the penalty and essentially just walking off, realising that this absolutely was the most blatant second. If you've got a booking, that's just not a sensible thing to do. You know, you're paid not to, specifically probably not to do that. So in case you're listening, don't do it again. West Ham 1-4-1 at Watford. Jacob, you're West Ham. Tony says, are West Ham massive again? I mean, they've had a bit of a dip, haven't they? But this was a good win against a really sorry Watford.
Yeah, Watford were really, really bad. They started well, obviously, and scored a very good goal through Dennis, who can't remember quite where he is in these standings, but is very much up there when it comes to goal involvements. He's got 13 this season, so that's kind of on sort of rivaling people like Salah and so on. So he does look like their one hope, and I think probably get onto this, but he'll looks like he's going to go off to the Africa Cup of Nations to play for Nigeria, unless Watford find a way of blocking it. And then once that early wave had kind of passed, they were absolutely terrible. West Ham just came straight back at them and took a while, but then they equalised and very quickly ahead. And I think that's one of the things with for Newcastle in particular, where you're looking at it and thinking, actually, there probably are three worse teams in the league than them. Ranieri, since he's come in, I mean, Ranieri did an appalling job at Fulham 2 years ago, and since he's come to Watford, has had 10 matches and has lost 8 of them. He's won 2. One of those was that freak win at Everton, you know, the 5-2, where they were 2-1 down with about 10 minutes to go, and then suddenly it finishes 5-2, which does feel like a bit of a freak occurrence. And then the last game of the Ole era. So those two wins, I think, probably have slight asterisks next to them. And then 8 defeats. It's not even draws. It's 8 defeats. I wouldn't be surprised if Ranieri isn't the Watford manager by the end of the season. They weren't able to lay a glove on Mark Noble, who was making his first start of the season because Rice was suspended, and he's never been that quick.
Here's a question from Grant. More likely to happen, England to beat Australia in the last 2 tests or Norwich to stay up? Troy, I mean, none of Norwich's starting 11 had scored a goal this season. Dean Smith's had 2 5-match losing runs in the Premier League this season, one with Villa, one with Norwich. Even when Palace scored, I think it was the second, he just put his hands on his head going, oh dear. I mean, that they're decimated like a lot of teams.
Yeah.
And if you're not the best team and you're decimated, that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, they started well, didn't they, for a couple of minutes, gave away the pen, and that was the end of the game. And that kind of sums up the way that they are. I'm still shocked that Dean Smith went to Norwich, to be totally honest.
Really?
So soon after Villa. He must have looked at the squad and what can you get out of that squad? You know, they weren't performing anyway. They're a yo-yo team. I think he's done his reputation nothing great, to be totally honest. I thought he might have waited a little bit longer, but you know, there's so many things about the game. You know, the Norwich fans singing about Billy Gilmore, you know, go back, which when I looked at Billy Gilmore's stats and realised that he was the most creative player on the ball for Norwich City, you wonder what game they're watching. The fact that they've, apparently racially abused Palace players and then racially abused their own players online. There's so much going wrong at that football club at the moment that's just not right. And then on the football pitch, they have a massive amount of endeavour, but nothing else. And, you know, you look at, you speak about the second goal from Mateta, who's only scored one goal before, which was in the derby. I'm going to call it a derby, although Palace fans will have a go at me against Brighton. And Norwich should have scored or should have had an attempt on goal, and they failed to do it. And within six passes, it's 2-0. And that's the be all and end all of Norwich. A lot of these clubs, you know, we spoke about Newcastle, we'll speak about Burnley, but as much as what they have got, a few players who can do a bit further up the pitch, defensively, they are all over the place. And Newcastle are going to need to address this as well, because defensively is where they've let themselves down. Norwich defence gives away treats like there's no tomorrow. So unless they can do something about defensively, I mean, I think they're gone already, but the table says that they're not. They're only a point behind Newcastle. So we should be talking about them in the same breath that we're talking about Newcastle at the moment. But Newcastle have money.
A 57-year-old man has been arrested in relation to the alleged racist abuse suffered by Palace players during that game. He was arrested for a racially aggravated public order offence, has been released under investigation. Norwich identified an individual after the allegations were made, have said investigations ongoing. They said they were disappointed to learn of online racist comments directed at some of their own players, which Norfolk Police are now investigating. Norwich City said, "We're identified, the club will support and impose the strongest possible sanctions against perpetrators." That'll do for part two. We'll discuss whether anyone should be playing football and if players should come back from loans, etc., etc. We'll talk a bit of AFCON as well in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Sideshow Dench says, should the Premier League offer central contracts to veteran unemployed footballers to fill in for teams who say they're short on numbers? Bentaleb, Ben Arfa, Boney and Wilshire all up for grabs. Adel Tarapt says, producer Sammy as well. Yeah, he'd be good to bring in. On a more sensible note, Rob says, should teams be able to call back players from loans at any time to help them fulfil fixtures? Or would that be incredibly unfair on lower league teams? It's not as if the EFL is pottering along nicely while the Premier League teams are struggling. Wilson, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the loan thing I think is difficult because you could really leave... I mean, unfortunately, we've sort of created a financial climate in which a lot of EFL teams are dependent on loans. And if they then suddenly lose players, to be no fault of their own, it does seem unfair on them. I think the whole thing at the minute is a mess. That, you know, we don't seem to know exactly what the rule is on when games can be cancelled. You know, Leeds had that game where they, the Arsenal game where they yeah, their entire bench, you have a total age of the bench is about, you know, 40. And then some clubs, you know, get games called off and the next game have somehow got 10 first team players playing. So, you know, I think there needs to be a more uniform and more transparent system for when games can be called off. And I think fundamentally if games, you know, if we're not stopping the season, then clubs probably should be incumbent on them to put academy players at least on their bench. And rather than just saying they haven't got anybody.
That's the thing that I don't understand. You know, everyone throughout the years, we talk about young players, producing young players, you know, giving young players opportunities. And here we have opportunities for young players at the very minimum to sit on the bench and to bolster their squads. That's what the under-23 squads are for. That's what the under-18 squads are for. And people are ignoring it. You know, Everton put out young Sims as their number nine in the Chelsea fixture. So it's an opportunity for young players to be a part of the squads and for young players to bolster when the injury crisis is, you know, is what it is at the moment. And I can't believe that teams are scratching around for players, to be totally honest.
Should we then take the arguments about player welfare less seriously by saying that these, especially at the Premier League level, there are enough footballers in those environments that they can actually look after their players themselves? Or is that too simple?
You can register 25 players, but we're talking about a club with however many players are out on loan and all these academy players who are there as well. I think that, I mean, it's interesting what Sean Dyche was saying about player welfare and, you know, what was it like in our day and everything. And he was saying that Frank Lampard used to play 60 games a season, never complained about anything. And you can take it too far and go too much like what it was like in my day. I think there's certainly an argument that this week's round of fixtures don't necessarily need to be played. You know, the Sunday, Tuesday turnaround does feel like it's way too much. But then there are decisions as well that managers are making, which, you know, as I said before with Tuchel, for example, where he's overplaying certain players and leading up to this, where they can also get around it, I think.
Yeah, but everyone knows the Christmas fixtures, don't they? The Christmas fixtures are the Christmas fixtures. The only thing that's changed there is that they've decided to spread them out over 3 days, which then has a knock-on effect to when the team can play next. And it's, listen, player welfare is massive and there has to be an understanding, but it also has to be an understanding from the management side of it as well, in how you utilise your players. They've got all enough figures, they've got enough stats, they know when players are not performing to the highest level or they're reducing in their kind of runs and all this, that and the other. So for me, it has to work both ways. The Premier League is never going to change its fixtures over the Christmas period. It's never going to change it. Well, it has to next year because of the World Cup, doesn't it? But in hindsight, it's not going to change that period of time. So managers have got to deal with it better. Yes, we are under extreme circumstances at the moment. But again, that's when we've got to look into our football club and utilise the assets that we have, or else they're not assets, which then says, well, why are they at the football clubs?
Also, the managers are complaining to us all the time, you know, the media over and over again and complaining and complaining and complaining. But the people who have the power to change it and to slightly alter the fixtures and the way that things are run is the clubs, are their bosses at the end of the day, because they all get together and they vote on this and they deal with the broadcasters. It's nothing to do with, newspapers or anything like that. It's all about what the clubs want to do and how the broadcast deals are structured. And, you know, they get all this money because they're all on television every single match. That's why partly that it's the richest league in the world and able to, as Jonathan said earlier, survive the pandemic in ways that other European clubs aren't.
Moving on, Jordan Jarrett Bryan, our friend, sent us a question going, how many football fans have spotted racism regarding AFCON? Sebastian Haller was asked by a reporter if he would prefer to stay with Ajax or play the African Cup of Nations. The question shows a lack of respect for Africa, he said. Would this question be asked to a European player before the Euros? Jurgen Klopp was in a debate with a journalist who said he disrespected AFCON by saying it was a, quote, little tournament. Klopp claimed his comments were ironic. I tend to think he was being ironic. Jordan didn't agree with me. We were texting about it before the pod. Ian Wright made a video saying, is there a tournament more disrespected than the African Cup of Nations? The coverage is completely tinged with racism. We played our Euros across 10 countries in the middle of a pandemic. There's no issue, but Cameroon, a single country hosting a tournament, is a problem. Claudio Ranieri's claimed Nigeria missed a deadline to call up Emmanuel Dennis for the Africa Cup of Nations, saying, quote, that email didn't arrive at the right moment. Oh, look, Wilson, you are someone who has been to many African Cup of Nations. You don't disrespect the tournament. I wonder what you think about all of this.
Well, there's an immediate problem. Well, look, there's a whole series of things here. So there's an immediate problem just with when it's played. I mean, Sebastian Haller might be right that there is a sort of disrespect for African football. But equally, the reason European players aren't asked that kind of question is because the Euros doesn't happen during the European season. Now, the timing of the Cup of Nations has been an ongoing issue. There was a move to try and standardise that with the rest of the world. So Cameroon was supposed to be hosting the Cup of Nations in June, July 2019 as part of this sort of wider rationalisation of the calendar, which led to the Cup America being brought in line with the Euros. So we'd go World Cup, blank year, Continental Tournament, blank year, World Cup. I think there's advantages for clubs in that. I think there's some certain disadvantages in that the Copa America, for instance, doesn't get the coverage now than it used to get because it's going straight up against the Euros. Now, can you host the Cup of Nations in Cameroon in June, July? Temperature-wise, it's not an issue. the temperature in Cameroon is pretty, you know, the average temperature varies, daytime temperature varies between 25 and 30 through the year. Actually, January is the hot period. It's you know, 29, 30. It would be cooler in June, July. But the issue is rainfall, that the Cameroon has two rainy seasons. You catch the end of the first rainy season in June. I don't know. I don't know what that means for pitches. I don't know how wet the rainy season is, but presumably it does create issues with humidity.
So Alex Ferguson would love it if he was playing Monaco. Be like, flooded. We're done.
Yeah, but the in November 2018, a decision was taken. The Cameroon hadn't fulfilled certain criteria it had to fulfil, so that tournament was moved to Egypt. Now, obviously, hosting the tournament in Egypt in June, July is no different to hosting it in southern Italy. It's hot, but it's not excessively hot. And then they moved Cameroon back to supposedly 2021, which suddenly we're told, no, you can't host it in June, July. We're going to have it in January. And that seemed very odd, that something they'd been prepared to do 2 years earlier, they suddenly weren't prepared to do. But then, obviously, with it being postponed, you couldn't have held it this summer, in summer coming, into summer 2022, because you're then 5 months from a World Cup. So it sort of has to be in January. Now, there's a historical reason, I think, why the Confederation of African Football has been reluctant to bend on the timing, which is a Cup of Nations was... the first tournament was 1957, so it's older than any other confederational tournament apart from the Copa America. It's older than the Euros, and the reason for that is that for a long time there was very little African representation at the World Cup. So the only way of getting international football was for Africa to have its own tournament. So African nations boycotted the 66 World Cup because there was half a place. You know, it was one African and Asian team combined. Which led to great representation through the 70s. Obviously 1957, politically, it's the same year that Ghana gains independence. There's that sort of wave of independence movements. It's a time of the end of colonialism, the sort of great sense of African self-determination. And the Cup of Nations is part of that movement. And one of the reasons that Ghana were the first great African team is Kwame Nkrumah, and you know, the reason they have the Black Star, which comes from Marcus Garvey's Black Star line, is because it was this sort of great anti-colonial movement, and Ghana were a great power in that. And Issa Hayatou, who was for a long time president of CAF before he was deposed in 2017, for all his many faults, there was always a great sense that he actually had the good of African football at heart. And that's why it's always been every 2 years. His argument was, well, it was always every 2 years. When you didn't want us, it was every 2 years. Now you do want us, we're still going to be every 2 years. You have to fit around us. And I think there's a certain sense to that. I think there's a certain logic to that. Hayatou's now gone. Ahmed came in and was pretty disastrous. Motsepe's now taken over. And I'm not convinced he's going to be a great thing. But that's why there was that sort of resistance to change. Now, the other immediate issue you've got now is COVID. But if you look at the prevalence in Cameroon, it's 113. Yeah, the 7-day average is 113. And now you can ask how widespread the testing is there. I think that's a reasonable question to ask. But given the borough I live in London has more than 20 times as many cases as the whole of Cameroon, I think once you're there, there's very little argument to say that that's less safe than travelling around England. There are issues with the ongoing conflict between the Anglophone West and the Francophone East in Cameroon. I think that potentially creates issues in Limbe, which is one of the five venues. Douala is sort of on the edge of that zone, but I think certainly by the time you get into Yaoundé in the middle of the country, it's pretty safe. And I honestly, I've done as much reading as I can on that. I don't know how much practical risk there is with that. I'd be very surprised if a couple of nations was targeted, because I think there's enough Cameroonian pride on both sides of the conflict in hosting a tournament.
Troy, obviously, you know, half our listeners are in the UK, right? They have a UK-centric view of football. I have a UK-centric view of football. Do you think there is, you know, you think Ian Wright is right when he says there's a sort of, it is tinged with racism?
Listen, absolutely spot on. I just, you think about the tournament, you think about the questions that were asked, you know, would you prefer to stay with your club rather than go to Africa and represent your country? For a start there, I mean, why would you ask that question first and foremost? You know, you're representing your country in a major tournament, with an opportunity to win that major tournament. And yes, it means that you miss a couple of league games, during that period of time. But, you know, the whole thing around the African Nations Cup, the way that it's spoken about or not spoken about, hopefully there's better coverage this time around, with the games being shown, you know, all the way through. There's just this disrespect towards the tournament that has existed for a very long time. I think Jonathan has said that, but it's just more so now that you think that with all the complications we have around the world at the moment, and the fact that, again, this is being held in one country, and will exist in one country. For me, I don't see where the problems are. The problems are your lack of respect for the tournament. The problems are your lack of respect for the players playing in the tournament. Although I'm no doubt there'll be scouts out there looking to unearth the next African player that they probably hadn't noticed, but has performed well in the cup.
All right. That's all we've got time for today. Jacob, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Max.
Jonathan Wilson, thank you.
Cheers, thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Troy.
Pleasure. Happy New Year too.
We'll be back tomorrow.